If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent breed is people!
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content. So if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hi and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 75. Yes, I'm three quarters of the way to 100 podcasts. This is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing the A to Z project, the first of the A to Z project, which should carry me through just past the 100th episode, unless I change something in the meantime. So, how is everybody? We're doing okay here. I'm actually touched with the flu at the moment. So, if I'm a bit vague and a bit out of focus, I do apologize. I'm going to try to pace myself putting this one together and really not try to push it too far, too fast, too hard. Oh, yeah, and before you ask, no, I didn't watch the Royal Wedding. I don't watch those sort of things. I'm very much a Republican, and I don't think that the fact that a helicopter pilot and a party planner got married is really anything for a couple of billion people to watch. I think it's one of the more sillier aspects of our society. So, having got that out of the way, I'm going to let you know what the two movies are that I'm going to talk about this time around. The first one is Jean-Luc Godard's 1965 science fiction film, Alphaville, starring Eddie Constantine and Anna Karenina. And the second film is All About Eve. It was declared the 16th best American film of all time by the American Film Institute. And it stars, of course, Betty Davis, Anne Baxter, and George Sanders. So, yeah, both of them very interesting films in their own way, very different films from each other. And I'm really enjoying the stretch that I have to go through to kind of incorporate these two films into one podcast and to talk about them meaningfully, because both All About Eve has been spoken about immensely by an immense number of people at various times and is one of the most studied movies in cinema, and Alphaville being one of the French Nouvelle Vague films, New Wave, and being a very atypical science fiction movie for any culture. And it's also a film that I found very challenging to watch. I really had to kind of peel back some preconceptions and really look at it with new eyes in a lot of ways. So, yeah, I did see some movies too. I have actually watched some other films, and I'm going to, as usual, bring up my Mizo listing of films that I've watched and go through it. The first one I'm going to talk about is Thor. I did see Thor in 3D. I got there before the end of the previous session, so I got to see the Easter egg that the Marvel films have at the end of each movie. before I actually saw the film, so I didn't have to sit through all of the credits again, which was quite good. And that also meant that I got a good position to watch the 3D aspects of the film, which was dead center, two rows from the back. And yes, I enjoyed it. I think Chris Hemsworth's good in it. I do like Anthony Hopkins playing Odin, even though he spends most of the movie asleep. Tom Hiddleston's very good playing Loki. Natalie Portman's in it. And I'm not convinced that Natalie Portman is the second coming of Sarah Bernhardt when it comes to acting. I think she's competent, but I'm not sure that she lives up to the PR that she gets. It's nice to see Rene Russo in a movie again, but she didn't have a lot to work with there. I don't know whether there was a lot left on the cutting room floor. But with a Marvel action film, bringing people into it and getting well-known names and faces into the film sometimes doesn't leave that opportunity to fully flesh out particular characters. That's the nature of that kind of genre. But I saw that. I recommend it. I don't know that the 3D works well in crowd scenes, particularly battle scenes. I think it works well when you've got two or three people on the screen at once. But when you've got like 50 or 60 people with swords and shields bashing against each other, I'm not convinced that it really does work as well as it should. I did rewatch a film from the 1980s, Explorers, which of course is a kids film where the kids create a spaceship and go meet people from outer space and that. Yeah, it's not too bad. I kind of liked it the first time around, but I think it's one of those films that means a lot more to people who saw it when they were a kid than it does to me who saw it when I was an adult. So it's not too bad. It was on Foxtel and I taped it and I watched it. And it wasn't a waste of time, but I think as the director Joe Dante has stated, the movie really was destroyed by the studios a bit. And knowing that, it does show when you watch the film. Let's see what else I saw. I saw a science fiction movie based on a science fiction novel written by Keith Lama called The Monitors from 1969, which was made by a lot of the Second City people from Chicago. Now, I hadn't seen it. I'd seen a very bad VHS copy of it, like fifth generation or something like that, years ago, and really didn't get it. It's a satire, and I don't think it always works, but it's got some interesting comedy actors in the film. And if you can get a copy of The Monitors, it's worth checking out for that. It's a bit hit and miss, not particularly well put together. I don't think that the satire is as solid as it might have been. So there is that. I did check out on Blu-ray Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. Now, I know it's the first part of a two-parter, and I think that making them into two separate films maybe is ill-considered, because my memory of this film is pretty much Harry, Hermione and Ron running through forests zapping people with wands. That seems to be pretty much most of what the movie is. Seeing it with the other, I may re-watch it again when the other one comes out and I can get them both back-to-back on Blu-ray, because we are collecting them on Blu-ray, and just see how they work as one film kind of hacked in half because of the requirements of a movie studio. So we'll see how that goes. I did watch Around the World in 80 Days, the old one with David Niven and a cast of thousands, and I did sort of like it, but it's a very episodic kind of film. They got prolonged sequences of bullfighting and cowboys and Indians in the Wild West and all sorts of things like that. It was made by Mike Todd, who at the time was married to Elizabeth Taylor. He died in an airplane crash not too long after this film was made. And I do like it for the cameos. You get Sinatra playing a piano in a honky-tonk. You get Gilbert Rowland in it. You get Cesar Romero. You get all these old actors. George Raft's in it, and Buster Keaton's in it. Just everybody kind of popped together as kind of just almost visually name-checked in this film. It was an enormous Cinerama epic in its day. And, of course, it's led on to the blockbuster films that we have now, and it's a direct antecedent of those things in a lot of ways. People think that the summer blockbuster started with Jaws, but there is some evidence that summer blockbustery films existed well before that time, and Around the World in 80 Days is definitely in that kind of genre. Let me have a look. What else did I watch? I did see a film which I kind of put in the same genre as a lot of the earlier Powell and Pressburger films. It was directed by a guy called Albert Lewin, and it's Pandora and the Flying Dutchman, starring Ava Gardner and James Mason. It's about a kind of rich, jaded woman in France, living on the coast of France and ruining the lives of her lovers, a lady called Pandora, of course, who meets the Flying Dutchman. And it's a great little film. It's mystical. It assumes a certain intelligence in the audience. It's very lyrical and what we now call magic realism. And I think it works really, really well. I don't think Ava Gardner has ever been more beautiful in a film, apart from maybe One Touch of Venus, where she played the goddess Venus. I think that this is a kind of start of that short time in the 1950s when Ava Gardner really nailed down how to act. She was an incredibly nervous person. She didn't think she could act. She lacked self-confidence in her profession to an enormous extent, which kind of fueled into her alcoholism later in life. There are other aspects of her life in which she had no problem with self-confidence at all. And that does show she was a very sexy woman in more ways than just on the screen. But it's a film worth seeing. It's in Technicolor, and it does have a kind of universe of its own that it populates. The narrator talks directly to the camera in a couple of places. And if you get a chance to read Lee Silver's biography of Ava Gardner, there's a lot more about the film in that and about the background to the film, which makes it even more interesting. But it's a film well worth seeing, and it is one of those films that was made as a labour of love by Albert Lewin. The guy, he also directed before that The Portrait of Dorian Gray in the mid-1940s. But this one really is the kind of the most passionate movie he made and the one that he really most loved. And even though it wasn't as popular and as successful as it might have been, it really is one of those films from the late 1940s, early 1950s that makes you wish that the enormous Hollywood blockbuster kind of films that came along to combat television would maybe put on the back burner a little bit and more of this kind of film were made, where there's not a large film, they're intelligent, they're artistic, they're just beautiful to look at. And we really needed more of those films at the time. And it's not a style of film that gets made very much now, but it is a very, very interesting piece of work. I did see a few other films as well, but I'm not really going to talk about them very much because there's at least one that I want to put into a podcast over the next few months. And I just want to kind of leave that for when we reach that part of the alphabet now that I'm doing the A to Z project, so that the film kind of gets revealed all of one piece in the podcast. So that's about it for that. I'm going to take a little bit of a break now and come back with the first of the two films. I think I'll do Alphaville because that's the one that's the most challenging. With my energy levels slightly less than they normally are, I want to get it out of the way first. So first piece of music I'm going to play is the star of Alphaville singing C'est Si Bon. Now, when I say the star of Alphaville, Eddie Constantine is the star of Alphaville. He plays the private eye, Lemmy Caution. I'm going to talk more about that in a moment. But he was also known as a song and dance man in France. He's an American actor who moved to France and became very successful as a kind of tough guy actor in the 50s and 60s. You'll also see him in The Long Good Friday, the Bob Hoskins, Helen Mirren film from the 1980s. He plays the American gangster that comes over and has a negotiation with Harold Shand, the character played by Bob Hoskins in that film. So here's Eddie Constantine, the song and dance man, singing C'est Si Bon.
Partir n'importe où, bras-dessus, bras-dessus, en chantant des chansons. C'est si bon de se dire des mots doux,
liberty reactive. Picking your heathen Lord. En voyant notre mine, habillé. Les passants dans la rue nous envient. De gaieté dans ses yeux, un espoir merveilleux, donne le frisson, c'est si bon,
ces petites sensations,
ça vaut mieux qu'un million, tellement, tellement c'est bon. C'est bon,
c'est bon, c'est bon
de se taper un whisky.
C'est bon
avec une chouette souris.
C'est bon
comme la monteur de gris. C'est si bon,
c'est bon,
que pour la grande passion.
C'est bon,
y a pas de morte saison.
C'est bon,
tellement, tellement c'est bon. En voyant notre mine ravieux, les passants dans la rue nous envieux, c'est bon de guetter dans ses yeux un espoir merveilleux, donne le frisson.
Okay, let's get stuck into Alphaville. It's a 1965 French science fiction movie by Jean-Luc Godard. Now, it isn't the first science fiction movie that Godard made. He was interested in science fiction from a pulpish sort of thing. He'd read comics, he'd seen some movies and things like that. He read some science fiction magazines that were translated into French. But the first science fiction movie he did was for a compilation piece called Rogopago, which was directed by four different directors, and each one of them made a small short film which was put together into a portmanteau film. The Rogopago is basically the names of the directors. Rossellini was the Ro part, Godard was the Go part, Pa was Pasolini, and the G at the end was Ugo Gregoretti. And the segment that Godard did was called The New World, basically, and it's a post-apocalyptic short science fiction movie. I do have a copy of it, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, so I'm looking forward to that. Apparently there's a smashed up Eiffel Tower in this film, and a whole bunch of other stuff like that. But of course Godard started out as a part of the Cahiers de Cinema mob, who basically put out a magazine which re-examined the minor films of American cinema. They're the guys who invented the words film noir, and they took a look at older films and found out that there was more depth to them than people realized, and they become very popular re-examining the Hollywood product of the 1930s and 1940s particularly, and into the 50s of course, and just kind of saying, hey, there's some stuff of value here that really does bear some examining. And they kind of moved on from there, and they gained a reputation. I mean, that mob included people like François Truffaut, of course, Godard, and Jacques Demy, Claude Chabrol, Jacques Rivette, basically who's who of French New Wave cinema. And Cahiers really did gain itself a reputation as the go-to film journal for anybody who seriously wanted to understand film. He He was just passionate. He lived and breathed cinema in a lot of ways, and really did come. His first really big success was he went and saw Orson Welles' Touch of Evil at Expo 58 in Paris, and based on that, he made his first feature film, Breathless, A Buddha Soufflé, in 1960, starring Jean-Paul Belmondo and Jean Seberg. And moved on from there. He was really influenced by people like Humphrey Bogart as an actor. He did a lot of Jean-Paul Belmondo in Breathless based on Bogart. And he really had an interest in directors like Ingmar Bergman, Sam Fuller, Fritz Lang, and really did worship these guys. Then, of course, 1965 comes along and we get to Alphaville. And you can look at this film from a number of different viewpoints. You can see it as a satire. You can see it as a comedy. You can see it as a science fiction film. You can see it as a film noir as well. But basically, the aspect, and also the other thing, one of the most important aspects of it, I should mention, is that the lead actress in the film was married to Jean-Luc Godard at the time. Her, of course, being Anna Karenina, who was married to him from 1961 to 1967. And in a lot of ways, the film is kind of set up as a love letter to his wife, as indeed various aspects of some of his other films that Karenina starred in were love letters to her. And the marriage wasn't an easy one because Godard would say, I'm going out for a little bit and then go to Sweden to talk to Ingmar Bergman and not come back, not tell his wife. So basically he was he didn't keep himself responsible to anybody else. He just did what he felt like doing. And of course this made it a very difficult relationship for her, not knowing whether he was going out for a packet of cigarettes or going out to fly overseas. He just didn't let her know what was happening in the relationship. And she said this in a couple of documentaries that have been made about him since then. He is still alive, by the way, and so is she. So, so things you need to know about Alpha before you go in and watch it. First off, it's a science fiction movie set on another planet in another galaxy in the future, which does not have one single special effect shot in it, and no piece of prop was made for the film. Here's what Godard and his people did. They filmed it in Paris, mostly at night time, but they filmed it in Paris, and just basically managed to convince you because of the way they framed the modern Paris. Now, a lot of the ancient, you don't see anything really old of Paris in this film. But the neon lights, the glass windows, the buildings, the elevators, the doors, the windows, the 1960s technology that he found when he was making this film, Godard uses it and frames it in such a way as to make the fact that he is in another time and another place believable in a kind of weird and off-kilter way. It's like you're slipping into an alternate universe. The protagonist, played by Eddie Constantine, is a private eye called Lemmy Caution, based on a private eye from the works of a minor English crime novelist of the 1940s and 1950s called Peter Cheney. And Eddie Constantine had made a number of Lemmy Caution movies where Lemmy Caution kind of veered between being a private eye and a secret agent at various times in the 1950s and into the early 1960s. So Godard basically adopted the Lemmy Caution character and put him into this weird science fiction film. And Lemmy Caution travels from Earth to this planet in another galaxy, the Alphaville planet, by driving a Ford Galaxy through the streets of Paris. That is a spaceship, is a Ford Galaxy car, a big American Yank tank of a car. Now, I don't know whether I'm putting this across very well, but it really is an unusual film. I'll try to give you a bit of a plot précis based on the Wikipedia side of things, but this one's a little hard to grab. Okay, here's what it says. Alphaville combines the genres of dystopian science fiction and film noir. Although set far in the future on another planet, there are no special effects or elaborate sets. Instead, the film was shot in real locations in Paris. The nighttime streets of the capital became the streets of Alphaville, while modernist glass and concrete buildings represent the city's interiors. In addition, the characters refer to 20th century events. For example, the hero describes himself as a Guadalcanal veteran. expatriate actor Eddie Constantine plays Lemmy Caution. And basically, it's a science fiction dystopia. There's a technocratic dictatorship in Alphaville run by a computer called Alpha 60. Now, the computer is represented by a blinking light, and the voice of the computer is the voice of a man who has had his voice box cut out because of cancer and uses one of those vibrator things against his neck. So it's kind of slightly Dalek-y, but it has a human but inhuman tone to it. I'll give you a little bit of an example about how Alpha 60 sounds. It doesn't sound like your traditional robot voice, which in American films would either be somewhat effeminate male voice or a very stilted Robbie the Robot kind of formal speech. Here's what Alpha 60 sounds like. And also note the background kind of music in it, just the kind of boom kind of music that sits in the background of this one. It's all the way through the film, and it does give a really weird sense of dread about it. But anyway, here's Alpha 60, and just listen to the voice, how it sounds human but inhuman, and also to the kind of, you know, the little chords that are played in the background to kind of build the tension in the scene, which is a very unusual method of doing it, but I think it's very effective.
Il arrive que la réalité soit trop complexe pour la transmission orale. La légende la recrée sous une forme qui lui permet de couvrir le monde.
Okay, I've got a kind of list here of things that I've noticed that Godard did in this film to really make it an interesting and kind of alien world. There's a long 4-minute tracking shot of Lemmy Caution coming into the hotel he's staying at in Alphaville. A single shot of him walking out of a car into the lobby, up a glass elevator one floor, down the hall, around and into his room. Now, Godard was referencing, of course, Touch of Evil in this, the big tracking shot at the start of Touch of Evil. He wanted to stretch himself technically and see whether he was capable of pulling off a similar kind of magic act by doing that. Now, of course, all the sets are just really normal places in Paris, in the newer part of Paris, in the newer buildings. But it's the way people act and the things said and the things done that give it the sense of being on another world. I mean, the hotel rooms come with complimentary tranquilizers because only a certain number of people can live under the oppressive regime in Alphaville without tranquilizers. Hotel guests have to register with something called civil control. Everybody has a number written on their body somewhere if they live in Alphaville, which, of course, references back to the Holocaust and things like that, is a very strong symbol of oppression. The female room attendants in the hotel are level 3 seductresses and will offer to take a bath with you. And each room has a really kind of groovy 1960s space age looking jukebox in it. And there are places on the streets in Alphaville called Rue Enrico Fermi and Boulevard Heisenberg, kind of referencing atomic age scientists. And the references to Earth being part of the outer countries in another galaxy. And it really does turn the kind of fluorescent strip lights and the streets of Paris into a really odd dystopia. There's a place called Ray of Light Avenue. And at one stage, Lemmy Caution visits a place called the Institute of General Semantics, where the meaning of words is altered. And people have a Bible in their room, which is actually a dictionary telling them which words they're allowed to think of and what the meanings of those words have become as Alpha 60 changes things. There's a ministry of dissuasion in Alphaville, and behaving illogically becomes a capital crime, which is usually carried out by in a swimming pool, where people are machine gunned and fall into a pool where synchronized swimming women stab them to death. Really weird stuff. There's a character in the film called Dr. Leonard Nosferatu, who in this case is played by Howard Vernon, who you might recall from any number of just Franco movies. And there are Professors Heckle and Jekyll in the film. And it's just a really weird thing. The original title that Godard was going to use for this film was Tarzan versus IBM. He wanted to have a kind of tough guy versus an omnipotent computer, and that was his whole real kind of reason for doing this film. And of course, during the film, it's discovered that Alpha 60 is about to declare preemptive war on the outer countries. It's sending brainwashed spies to the outer countries in anticipation of this, who are programmed in these really weird institutes that Alpha 60 has set up in Alphaville. And yeah, it's a challenging film. It's a hard one to get your head around. To be honest with you, it's only this time that I watched it. I've watched it five times. It's only this time that I've watched it that I really got into the headspace of believing that the streets of Paris are a foreign place. And the way I did that was by focusing on the actions of the people and just letting the scenes and the props that they use, which are just little bits of 1960s technology, just letting them sit in the background and finding the strangeness and the alienness in the minds and the actions of the people. There's a little scene with the character actor Akim Tamarov, which really is weird and kind of strangely alien. These people are mind-fucked in a very literal sense in Alphaville and act like they are as well. Now, what Godard did was he gave the actors a kind of general idea of where he wanted each scene to go. And to a large extent, he let them improvise the thing, which in a science fiction movie where you've got to have that kind of plot progression and you've got to have logic of some kind in there, adds that little frisson of randomness to the film, which really kind of does make it work. And for people who kind of know movies, you can get a little more out of them if you know a lot about film. But again, it's not necessary that you do know a lot about a film. Once you accept the conceit that Paris is being shot as an alien planet run by a supercomputer represented by a blinking light and a guy with a cancer-damaged larynx, you kind of go along with it. I mean, the voice of Alpha 60 is a reference to a number of things, including Dr. Mabuse from the Fritz Lang Mabuse films, particularly Testament of Dr. Mabuse in 1933. It's a kind of omnipotent and omnipresent strangeness that really is changing the nature of what it is to be human. And ultimately, the redemption of both Lemmy Caution and the character played by Anna Karen, whose name is, he said, checking this out, because names, she uses about two or three different names. Natasha von Braun, of course, which is a reference to Werner von Braun. The redemption of them is love, basically. And, of course, that's a reference back to Jean-Luc Godard's relationship with Anna Karenina. Now, I hope I'm explaining this okay, because it's a very hard movie to explain without showing pictures, because so much of it is visual and so much of it is really something that needs to be seen to be experienced. And one of the other references that apparently Godard makes in this film is to Jean Cocteau's work. In a sense, Alphaville is a story of Orpheus, somebody descending into hell to rescue somebody. And it really is a little bit like that. And it does have those kind of mythic echoes to it when you watch it. Now, the film's been influential as well. I know there's a clothing boutique in Melbourne called Alphaville. And there is a Swedish alternative rock band called Alpha 60. And there's another band, a German synth pop band called Alphaville. And strangest of all, and weirdest of all, and funkiest of all, there's a gated community in Sao Paulo, Brazil, called Alphaville, which was created in the 1970s as a kind of, you know, suburb of the future, you know, which still exists. And it's very much kind of funky and, for the 1970s, futuristic. So the film has had a lot of influences there. And ultimately would have influenced movies like Blade Runner, where you have the Rick Deckard character traveling through the futuristic city. And there's no way known that Ridley Scott hasn't seen Alphaville. So that's pretty much all I want to say about the film. As I said, it's a challenging one. It's a little hard to get your head around unless you kind of really let go of your own preconceptions and just roll with the flow of, yes, this is an alien world. Yes, this is a private eye traveling through a dystopia. Even though the visuals can be interpreted as just being a guy wandering through the streets of Paris. Really, it's a challenging film. I'm going to have to watch it again maybe in 6 months' time, one more time, and just get totally comfortable with the idea. And I think it works really well at what it attempts to do, and it doesn't make it easy for the viewer. You know, you really do have to kind of reprogram your mind a bit to get the full value from this film. And while I don't think it's a perfect film, and I think that, yeah, it's an enormous conceit to turn the streets of Paris into an alien planet, I think the fact that somebody, you know, embraced that conceit and really kind of ran with it and made a film that's been so influential in doing so is very much a worthwhile thing. We really do need other people's visions in films, and we need to have that kind of alien mindset which takes us out of ourselves and says, okay, I'm going to roll with this and I'm going to accept this world on its own terms. Which, of course, people do reading a lot of science fiction novels, but you don't have the visual stimulus at odds with what you're being told in the movie to the extent that you do in Alphaville. Anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and after that we're going to talk about a much more accessible film, all about Eve, directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz and starring Bette Davis, George Sanders and Anne Baxter. So the music I've chosen to play next, and I'm pinching all of this stuff at the moment from YouTube, so it's all out there, and if there's copyright infringement, it's YouTube's, not mine. It's from 1942 Warner Brothers musical called Thank You Lucky Stars, and it is Bette Davis singing a song about not being able to find a bit on the side during World War II.
You marched away and left the town as empty as can be. And I am like the driftwood in a deadly calm at sea. I can't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. For there is no secret lover that the draft board didn't discover. They're either too young or too old. They're either too gray or too grassy green. The pickings are poor and the crop is lean. What's good is in the army. What's left will never harm me. They're either too old or too young. So, darling, you'll never get stung. Tomorrow I'll go hiking with that Eagle Scout, unless I get a call from Grandpa for a snappy game of chess. They're either too warm or too cold. They're either too fat or too fast asleep. So, darling, believe me, I'm yours to keep. There isn't any gravy. The gravy's in the Navy. They're either too fresh or too stale. There is no available mail. I will confess to one romance, I'm sure you will allow. He tries to serenade me, but his voice is changing now. They're either too bald or too bold. I'm down to the wheelchair and bassinet. My heart just refuses to get upset. I simply can't compel it to, with no Marines to tell it to. I'm either their first breath of spring, or else I'm their last little fling. I either get a fossil or an adolescent pup. I either have to hold him off or have to hold him up. The battle is on, but the fortress will hold. They're either too young or too old. I'll never, never fail you when you are in Australia, or out in the Aleutians, or off among the Russians, and flying over Egypt, your heart will never be dipped. And when you get to India, I'll still be what I've been dear. I've looked the field over, and lo and behold,
before we get into all about Eve, there's one more thing I want to say about Alpha Will that I forgot to mention before. Eddie Constantine got his start in the cabarets in Paris by becoming the lover of Edith Piaf. Now, if you look through the history of Piaf, you'll find that any number of famous French singers and actors got their start in her bed. She really was a mentor in a very odd way for some of the best and brightest French stars of the time. It really is weird to see. But anyway, let's get on to All About Eve. Just had to stop there for a bit of a coughing and a sneezing fit, so I must be unwell. 1950 this film came out. It was directed, as I said, by Joseph L. Mankiewicz, and it was nominated for a shitload of Oscars. Let's see how many nominations it got. 14 Academy Award nominations, a feat that went unmatched until 1997 when Titanic got it, and it won 6, including Best Picture. And it's the only time in Oscar history where a film received 4 female acting nominations. Bette Davis and Ann Baxter for Best Actress, and Celeste Holm and Thelma Ritter for Best Supporting Actress. So the film was number 16 on the AFI's 1998 list of the 100 Best American Films, and rightly so. It's a lovely piece of work, and there are some interesting choices made in the film. Now, I'm going to give you a bit of a background on it, and then talk about why I find this film so interesting. Okay. At an awards dinner, Eve Harrington, Ann Baxter, the newest and brightest star on Broadway, is being presented with the Sarah Siddons Award for her breakout performance as Cora in Footsteps on the Ceiling. Theatre critic Addison DeWitt observes the proceedings and, in the sardonic voiceover, recalls how Eve's star rose as quickly as it did. The film flashes back a year. Margot Channing, Bette Davis, is one of the biggest stars on Broadway, but despite her unmatched success, she is beginning to show her age. After a performance one night, Margot's closest friend Karen Richards, played by Celeste Holm, wife of the play's author Lloyd Richards, played by Hugh Marlowe, meets a besotted fan, Eve Harrington, in a cold alley outside the stage door. Recognising her for having passed her many times in the alley, Karen takes her backstage to meet Margot. Eve tells the group gathered in Margot's dressing room, Karen and Lloyd, Margot's lover Bill Sampson, Gary Merrill, and Margot's maid Birdie, Thelma Ritter, that she followed Margot's last theatrical tour to New York after seeing her in a play in San Francisco. Margot quickly befriends Eve, moves her into her house, and offers Eve a job as her assistant, leaving Birdie, who dislikes Eve, feeling put out. So the arc goes from there. Now, Addison DeWitt is to be honest with you, there's not a bad bit of acting in this film. Everybody is pitch perfect, which is one of the lovely things about it. Each character who is introduced, no matter how small, has their own arc. Some of them are upward arcs, some of them are downward arcs, some of them redemptions, some of them are bittersweet. And that's part of the joy of the film, just seeing this. And the strongest characters in the film are women. They're not the male characters, apart from perhaps Addison DeWitt, who himself is an ambiguous character because one of the things that a lot of the research I've done on this film has stated is that two of the characters, Addison DeWitt, the film critic, and Eve herself, are gay. Addison has an interest in Eve, but it's not a sexual interest one tiny bit, and he's very kind of dry and droll and very much kind of bitchy queenish. And there are a number of points in the film where Eve is coded as being a lesbian, including her adulation of Margot Channing, just the way she does certain looks at certain people, the way she tends to bond well with women and manipulate men rather than have a genuine emotional attachment to them. And a lot of critics of this film have construed that as being gay. You can read it that way, you can not read it that way. It doesn't really matter, but it does add an extra interesting depth to the film if you do recognize the possibility of these two characters being homosexual. Before I play a bit of audio from the film, I want to say something about Thelma Ritter, who is fast becoming one of my favourite actresses of all time. Now, she didn't play main roles, she played secondary roles. She was nominated for a Best Supporting Actress Oscar literally half a dozen times. She holds the joint record with Deborah Kerr of being nominated 6 times for an Academy Award and not winning one. Which to me is a shame, because all you got to do is think of her in a movie like Pick Up on South Street, the Sam Fuller film. Her death scene in that film is gut-wrenching and stabs right to the heart of a character in a way that takes an enormous confidence and skill to portray. And also it takes a kind of rawness that really does fill me with awe every time I watch it. I will rewatch Pick Up on South Street just to see Thelma Ritter. And in this one, she plays Birdie, who is a kind of dresser assistant to Margot Channing, the big Broadway star. And the lovely thing about Birdie, the character, is she is the first person to see through Eve and to see what kind of manipulative, lying cow Eve actually is. And I really like that. I like the fact that a minor character who is not, you know, one of the bigger roles and not one of the kind of standout over-the-top roles of this film is the most perceptive person in the room when they all sit down and first hear the story of her life from Eve. That's fantastic. Now, of course, Addison DeWitt is the other character who really susses Eve out early and knows who and what she is pretty much from the first time he meets her. And that I do like as well. It really is a very interesting dynamic that these are the two people in the film who have really got their finger on the pulse and who can see through the bullshit. I mean, as an audience, and as a jaded 21st century audience, it may be very easy to see through ourselves. But in the world of the film, it takes other characters a time to see who and what Eve Harrington actually is. Now, there's also a smaller role, which was kind of a breakthrough role for a very, very, very famous actress. Marilyn Monroe stars as Miss Cardwell, whom Addison DeWitt escorts to Eve's party, the really kind of iconic party that's a centerpiece right in the center of the film, where Betty Davis gets to say this.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
And Addison DeWitt steers Miss Cardwell, who looks stunning in an evening dress with a lot of decolletage to it, in the direction of Max Fabian, who is the producer of the film, played by a character actor called Gregory Ratoff. And the interesting thing about this is there's a beautifully comic little piece of work there. Marilyn Monroe plays it just right as not too bright but very determined and pretty worldly starlet who is trying to improve her lot in the food chain of theatre. And there is an arc to her story later on as Addison DeWitt and her have a bit of a conversation after she does an audition for Max Fabian. So it's an interesting little piece. It's not a large role, but it's a meaty role, and it's one of those ones that brought Marilyn Monroe to the attention of the studios and kind of lit a skyrocket underneath her and allowed her to become one of the great stars of that decade, the 1950s. Now, for those of you who have seen the film before, and I hope if you haven't, you see it, and if you have, you watch it again. Here's something for you to remember and to show you how much times have changed since 1950. Betty Davis, at the time she made All About Eve, as the aging star Margot Channing, was exactly the same age then as Jennifer Aniston is now. It shows you how people, the actors and actresses have changed. 42 is not an old age for even an actress these days, as much as it was then. Yes, they do start to lose roles and end up playing the mother in television shows and things like that at a premature age. And there's still that kind of barrier for older actors, female actors, in Hollywood in particular, less so in England. In England, there's a certain amount of embracing of the skills and the experience brought to the game by older actors and actresses. But Margot Channing is not an old person in this film, but in the world she's chosen to conduct her career, she's perceived as being old. And this, of course, is one of the lovely things. Betty Davis left herself open to the rawness you need for that kind of portrayal. And also, well, basically, Margot is a bitch, but as you understand her better, you understand the deep insecurity that makes her as bitchy as she is during the story of this film. And ultimately, she does find a kind of redemption, which is really nice, and her story ends well before the end of the film, which is probably about apt, because there is a kind of nice sting in the tail of this film, which I'm not going to spoil, but which is worth waiting for. And also intensifies that possibility of Eve Harrington being a lesbian. But and Margot Channing is one of the great actress roles of the 1950s. Both Anne Baxter and Betty Davis lost out because they were both in the same film, both nominated for Best Actress, to Judy Holliday in Born Yesterday for the Best Actress Oscar, which is a shame because I really think Betty Davis's role is the stronger one. It's not as funny and silly as Judy Holliday's role in Born Yesterday, but I really think it's one of those roles in a film which we understand better now than a lot of people did then. We understand that kind of dismissal of women once they get past being cute and pert, which unfortunately still does occur. There's and you can see it in modern times. There's been a recent incident where a kind of minor Australian actress who had a short career in Bollywood was arrested for drunkenness in a nightclub in the Gold Coast recently. Interesting thing. She's exactly the same age as Margot Channing is in All About Eve. So this kind of stuff does occur. I'm not saying she's anywhere near as talented as Betty Davis is, but there is a kind of end date to some careers, which unless the person can reinvent themselves, unfortunately still occurs. And I suppose it does to a certain extent for male actors as well, but more so for female actors. And I'm not sure what the solution to that is. I mean, all of the interesting character roles are played by older actors, things. But, there are a number of older actors as well, female actors, that are, they blow other people off the screen every time they're on the screen. People like Judi Dench, for instance. And Maggie Smith, even these days, you look at them on the screen and you're not looking at anybody else. because of what they bring to the game and because of those decades of experience and because of that self-knowledge that comes with time. And I really do like that about this film, the fact that the female characters who allow themselves to be open to self-knowledge do thrive, and the ones who delude themselves, you can see the world coming at them at 100 kilometres an hour. And that's an interesting place for a film to be. I mean, a lot of people have kind of flagged this film as homophobic because the shallow, bitchy characters are the ones who are coded as gay. But I don't really think so, because I'm kind of thinking about Addison DeWitt. But I think Addison DeWitt has a couple of redeeming qualities in the film, which stop him from being a stereotype of the bitchy arch queen. And one of them is, he's the first person that sees through Eve apart from Birdie, who has the wisdom of age. Another thing is, when he confronts Eve, he shows that he has strongly held beliefs about war widows and about the sacrifices made by soldiers during World War II, which really, you know, he doesn't just use it as a way of stinging her, the way it's portrayed by George Sanders. But it's used because Addison strongly believes, he doesn't believe in many things, but this is something he strongly believes in and he's actually appalled by, and he uses for his own advantage ultimately, which I find really interesting, that kind of extra layer that the script gives him to play with in that character, which could be kind of just the arch, sophisticated cynic, shows that he's not quite as cynical as we've been led to believe. And I really do like that. I like that kind of, that little extra bit that always makes me smile when I find it in a movie script, where they show that, yes, we're aware that we've been portraying this character as two-dimensional for a while, but here you go. And then revealing that. And that's one of the lovely things. And, of course, George Sanders. Interesting thing about the film, George Sanders' wife turned up on set a lot. He was married to Zsa Zsa Gabor at the time, who was deathly jealous of the scenes that George Sanders had with Marilyn Monroe. And George, of course, being a gentleman very fond of women, she kind of hung around to make sure that he wasn't tilting his hat in the direction of Marilyn Monroe. Of course, he wasn't her type at all. But interesting that occurred. And, of course, very soon afterwards, they parted. And ultimately, in about 1972, George Sanders took his own life because basically he was bored with living and took a whole bunch of sleeping pills in a hotel in Spain, which is a shame. It really does show you the isolation. I mean, in a 20-year period, George Sanders went from this film, where he won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar, to doing just Franco spy films. And he went from Rossellini's Voyage to Italy to doing just Franco films. And it shows that he's kind of like the real-life Margot Channing of this piece. He ended up getting less and less roles. And of course, so did Betty Davis. Eventually, she ended up playing grotesques and monsters right at the end of her career, playing kind of nicer old ladies. But that innate insecurity and that bitchiness that first came to pass in All About Eve became something she did. Things like Whatever Happened to Baby Jane and films like that, and The Nanny, and The Anniversary, which she did for Hammer, really showed that kind of older women as grotesque, which became part of the lexicon of exploitation cinema in the 1960s. And the other thing I should mention is that All About Eve was made into a musical and was on Broadway in 1970, starring Lauren Bacall. It was a musical called Applause. I haven't been able to track down the soundtrack to this yet, but I'm going to, and I'm going to listen to it and just see how it parallels with the original film version. But anyway, here's a bit of the dialogue at the dinner party between Margot Channing, Miss Cardwell, played by Marilyn Monroe, and George Sanders as Addison DeWitt. It's very bitchy and arch dialogue, particularly given the fact that there has been some animosity between the characters before this occurs.
I distinctly remember Addison crossing you off my guest list. What are you doing here?
Dear Margot, you were an unforgettable Peter Pan. You must pray it again soon. You remember Miss Caswell,
don't you? I do not. How do you do? We've never met. Maybe that's why.
Miss Caswell is an actress, a graduate of the Copacabana School of Dramatic Art. Ah, Eve.
Good evening, Mr. DeWitt. I had no idea you two knew each other.
This must be at long last our formal introduction. Until now, we've only met in passing.
That's how you met me. In passing.
Yes.
Eve, this is an old friend of Mr. DeWitt's mother, Miss Caswell, Miss Harrington.
Miss Caswell, how do you do?
Addison, I've been wanting you to meet Eve for the longest time.
It could only have been your natural timidity that kept you from mentioning it.
You've heard of her great interest in the theater.
We have that in common.
Then you two must have a long talk.
I'm afraid Mr. DeWitt would find me boring before too long.
You won't bore him, honey. You won't even get a chance to talk.
Claudia, come here. You see that man? That's Max Fabian, the producer. Now go and do yourself some good.
Why do they always look like unhappy rabbits?
Because that's what they are. Now go and make him happy.
I love the dialogue in this film. Not only is it arch and bitchy and knowing, but it really does serve the really great use. It's not just there for shock value and for laugh lines and for bitchiness. It does convey the character and it does move the story forward when they are talking like this, theatrically and amusingly and incredibly wittily. It really does move the story forward rather than stopping it dead, which I kind of like. I think that's always a great piece of a script, is when you find really interesting stuff happening and it doesn't slow things down. It actually puts a rocket under it. Anyway, I'm going to take another break now and then I'll get into the feedback. Yes, we have feedback, and we have feedback from Brian and Dr. Zom talking about a character actor, and it's all fun and games until somebody loses an eye. The next bit of music I've got is George Sanders singing. Yep, from Call Me Madam. He sang a song with Ethel Merman in Call Me Madam in the 1950s, and I thought, given that we've got a little bit of this happening with the actors in the movies I'm talking about singing, here it is, George Sanders singing from Call Me Madam.
Well, forgive me, but perhaps with Americans, money is a little too important. There are more valuable things than money.
That's what money's for, to buy them with.
Oh, with money you cannot buy...
What can't you buy?
Ooh, many things. For one, love. A happy marriage?
Well, I thought that marrying for money was sort of an old custom around here.
Oh, yes, and in my own family for generations. But to me, a marriage for money, something never to do. I learned that lesson when a child.
You were married when you were a child?
No, I learned it from my parents, my grandparents, my uncles, my great uncles, my cousins.
10 generations of Constantines lived very comfortable lives. They were contented to live in style, supported by their wives. Daughters of men who were wealthy fitted them like a glove. They all married for money. I mean to marry for love. It's an old-fashioned idea, marrying for love. And that old-fashioned idea's what I'm thinking of. Where there's love, poets have said, two can live as one. That's an old-fashioned idea, but it's being done. If she must have gold, let it be in her hair. Rubies, let them be in her lips. Diamonds, let them shine in her eyes. Just an old-fashioned romance with the moon above. A romance, one that will end, marrying for love. That's the kind of love that I'm thinking of. that's the kind of love that I'm thinking.
Okay, now that I've recaffeinated and relaxed and had another sneezing fit, it's time for the feedback. The first one is from Brian over at the Hammockus Podcast, upon which I am appearing later this month, doing a minor Hammer crime film called Maniac, starring Kerwin Matthews. Anyway, here's Brian.
Hey, Terry. Brian here. Just a bit of feedback for your Frankenstein, Wolfman, and Dracula episode. Very much enjoyed them as always. You always have those little tidbits, you know, to bring to the table. Obviously, I'm more of a Hammer man myself, but yes, I have seen the original Universals, but they didn't really tickle my fancy back in the days as much as Christopher Lee and Cushing and they did. So, but yes, happy days. So, I've got myself a little Karloff story for you. Back when I was a young lad growing up in the fields of Ulster, there was a farmer that converted his garage into a little cinema that would play the old films, because we lived too far away from the cities to get to the cinema. So he converted his cinema, and he would play the old films for us. And he would also play the newer stuff too, because he needed to make a bit of money, you know, to keep the place running. But lots of fond memories there. But also, Karloff, Boris Karloff's, I think it was either his great-granddaughter or his granddaughter or niece or something, somebody, would come to visit family in Northern Ireland, Ireland. And she would come to the cinema, and he would play the old films, you know, so she could see them, because she hadn't seen many of his works. And he'd built up a nice collection of original posters and artwork. That she would come and relive the stuff and see. But, you know, as it goes, as these stories, you know, always end in tragedy. But these bad lads found out about it, and they broke in and stole all the posters, which is unfortunate. But yeah, so that's my story about Karloff. But to tie in with your most recent episode about Northern Ireland with Odd Man Out, you know, another wonderful film that I love, because it's about my home country, no matter how colorful and tragic the history of my homeland is. But what I enjoy about that is because they used a lot of just normal people as the extras, and I always watch it and wonder if my granny and grandpa might be there standing around in the crowd scenes, because I know it was filmed around their streets where they lived. And recently there was a manhunt itself to find some more of the colourful characters on the TV back home, and they actually found a couple of the little children that were playing football. It's the ones that say, "Give us a penny, and if you get give us some cigarettes instead." And they found one of the fellas in Liverpool, I think, or the South Docks, and he's 72 years old now. And it's interesting, you can find some of the stuff online, how they interviewed him, and, you know, to talk about how he got paid and stuff for the film. So it's always interesting, you know, to find stuff that so you can look back and see how your own hometown has changed over the years. Because I know Belfast has certainly had a interesting history and past, but certainly has changed a lot. So happy days. Love the show as always. Cheers.
Yeah, thanks for that, Brian. I had the same thing when I watched exploitation films set in Sydney in the 1970s, because that's where I grew up. And Sydney, again, like Belfast, has had a lot of changes. And it does kind of connect back for you. It really does have a strong emotional resonance when you look on those things and realise that the town that you were born and raised in has a cinematic history, some of which is available. I mentioned that when I talked about the Siege of Pinchgut a while back, how that's the only footage I have of how Sydney looked around the time I was born, because Australia's film industry really wasn't gangbusters at that time. But Brian sent me a couple of other voicemails, and I'll just play the next one now.
Hey, Terry, Brian again. So I know you're doing your alphabetical reviews, but I was just wondering, so I've had this idea for yourself for quite a while now, but if you were interested in doing you know, a remake show, a double show. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Fritz Lang's 1941 Manhunt, which I think is a very interesting film because it was his first film after he left Germany to come to America. And it's about, you know, a British lord or a British member of the aristocracy that is on a hunting trip in Austria, and he gets captured by the SS because he's either aiming his sights in the direction of Hitler or he is about to assassinate Hitler. And then it ensues in that. I just think it's a very brave take from Fritz Lang to make that film. And then it was remade in 77 as a made-for-TV film with my main man, Peter O'Toole, which is where I first came to it. I came to the Peter O'Toole one first, and that's actually called Rogue Mail. So I think it'd be a very interesting concept for your show to do, you know, a remake show. They're both very different films. I personally prefer the Rogue Mail to Manhunt, but, you know, it'd be cool once you get through your alphabetical one. So anyway, always love the show, and tune in every week. All right, cheers.
Thanks, Brian. A remake show would be fine. You know, the original and the remake back-to-back would be something I can definitely do in the future. And I do like Manhunt and Rogue Mail. I think I prefer Manhunt because, well, for starters, it's got George Sanders playing a Nazi in it. And even though Walter Pidgeon playing the protagonist is a bit weaker, the fact that it is Fritz Lang's first Hollywood film makes it interesting. Though I'd be more likely to pair up Manhunt with something like Ministry of Fear, which is another Fritz Lang wartime film with Ray Milland. But yeah, I can see the point. And the remakes, original and a remake together will be an interesting thing to do. So it's going into my book. And once I get through the whole alphabet, I'm going to do it. I may actually break up the alphabet thing too. If I decide I want to do something like a remake show, I'm going to put it on hiatus for one podcast and then go back to the alphabet. I'm going to get through A to Z. There's no two ways about that. But maybe if I want to kind of step outside that for one episode, I will do so. But they're both good suggestions. And I always like Peter O'Toole in movies as well. I like him doing like comedy. I like him doing the serious stuff as well. And really, you know, Lawrence of Arabia is not one of my favourite films. I do like watching it occasionally. But I do have some. I'm actually looking right now. I've just looked over at my bookshelf. And I've got Nicholas Wapshot's biography of Peter O'Toole sitting there on the shelf. So, yeah, some stuff with Peter O'Toole is definitely on the cards. I've just written it into the book and the remake idea as well. So we'll definitely look into that. And here's Brian's third voicemail.
Okay, Terry, Brian again. You were talking, mentioning about your Welsh heritage and St. David's Day. Unfortunately, St. David's Day has passed. It was in March the 1st. So you'll have to wait till next year if you want to do a Welsh show. It came up when I was talking about St. Paddy's Day and Dario Gill. So if you are interested in doing one, you know, you can always do Camelot with Richard Harris and Franco Nero, 67, I think that was. Nice musical for yourself. Because as I say, Camelot, if it existed, most likely is the entire country of Wales. So that's a bit of knowledge for you there. And you can also have it if you want to do it, cook yourself a nice bit of Welsh rarebit, which is basically cheese on toast, and have a nice, fun, interesting viewing of Camelot, which I, for one, would certainly tune in for. All right, cheers.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, Camelot's definitely a possibility. I do like Camelot. I think that Vanessa Redgrave was never sexier than she was in Camelot as well. But I'd probably top it up with something interesting like Under Milkwood, the one that Richard Burton did with Elizabeth Taylor in it, the kind of rendition of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood. Just the euphony of the language would make it a really nice one to do as well. So I'm going to have to send myself a reminder. So if anybody out there wants to remind me around mid-February that I need to do something Welsh for St. David's Day, do so. Happy to have everyone be an alarm clock for me if you like. But thanks for that, Brian. Love your support, mate. And I'm glad that I'm going to be a part of Hammickers. Really looking forward to it because I haven't actually, for a very long time, podcasted with anybody else. So that give and take, I think, is a good exercise for me. In a sense, it's what I do when I talk to Ivor Kohler on ABC Radio in Darwin, which I'm going back to. I just got some feedback from Ivor, which is really great. We're doing it again on the 5th of March. May, 5th of May, when we're looking at Angel Face, which I've done on the podcast before. We're going to do Angel Face, and we're going to make it regular on Thursday nights, which is really going to be a groovy thing. And I was talked over with the powers that be in the ABC, and they're going to give us a little more time to play with on this one, 20 to 25 minutes, which is fantastic. Love that idea. And on Thursday nights, I get a phone call, and Ivor and I shoot the shit across the Northern Territory about movies. And the feedback that he's got from the management is that we've got a great rapport and that what we do is of value to them, which I really like. Anyway, it's on to an email, and then I'm going to end with Dr. Zom. But here's the email we got. It's from Rob Kelly, and I'll just read it out here. Let me bring it up. Dear Terry, just wanted to drop you a line to say how much I like the podcast. I discovered it a few weeks ago when I did a search on George Pal and found your Pal-centric episode, which I enjoyed. So I subscribed and have been catching up with the show since. The tone is a bit more highbrow than a lot of other movie podcasts, many of which I enjoy, but not stuffy, which I think is a good combo. I too enjoy Shortcuts because Julianne Moore goes bottomless in it. Also, maybe because you're in Australia and I'm in America, but you seem to have access to some movies that I can't get here, at least on DVD. I remember watching 99 and 44 100% Dead on VHS back when I worked in a video store, which adds another dimension to the show. I'm in the middle of listening to your Universal Monsters episode, and even though I know these films backwards and forwards and they are a major inspiration for my artwork, I still enjoy hearing you discuss them. Keep up the good work, and if there's something you mentioned that I don't get, I will fucking Google it. Take care, Rob Kelly. I'll put Rob's links up on the show notes for this one too, because Rob's website for his writing and his illustrations, he's given me the links for that. Thanks for that, Rob. Yeah, Julianne Moore, Ginger Bush, gotta love that. And yeah, she's one of the actresses for whom I have a not entirely intellectual interest in. I think she's sexy, basically, and I think also she's a fine actress, which is nice. I really don't tend to go for actresses that are just cute looking, but I've got a thing for interesting looking people who are also good at what they do. And so thanks for that. And now we have the inevitable and the inexplicably groovy Dr. Zom. Here's his little update on what Zom has been watching.
Paleo Cinema. This is Dr. Zom. Paleo Cinema, just wanted to give you a call to discuss a bit of a marathon, an impromptu marathon that I had the other morning that involved one actor that holds a special place in my heart. And that actor is Victor McLachlan. We have a channel over here in America, some of us who are lucky enough, and it's called This, T-I, wait a minute, This? Yes, T-H-I-S. And basically what it is they show just exclusively old MGM movies, and a lot of them are out of print. Anyway, I happened to luck upon on my day off, which, because I work midnight shift, to some people would be, I guess it still would be a day off after midnight, but I usually am up all night, and started out with Sea of Fury from 1958, and this starred Victor McLachlan, and also a Paleo Cinema favorite, or someone who has been talked about quite a few times on Paleo Cinema, and that is Stanley Baker. Pretty good movie. 1958, Victor McLachlan was actually, you know, getting up there in years. He played a crusty old tugboat captain, and they would get special bonuses to go rescue battleships and cargo ships that were in distress or about to sink at sea. And it was really cool because it had some it kind of went between a lighthearted affair with McLaughlin and another, I think it was a Dutch tugboat captain. They always had a drink in the bar, and they were good friends, but they had a rivalry of who would get to, you know, a ship first, and who would they would always bet, you know, a certain amount of money. And anytime Victor McLaughlin is involved in scenes where he is drinking beer or in a pub, it's always entertaining, as you probably know from the movie The Quiet Man. He kind of has an Italian man basically promise his, say, 20-year-old daughter to him. And, you know, he's old and, you know, he's not a bad man or anything, but, you know, there's a big age difference there. And, of course, when he sees the 20-year-old hoochie-macooch, he's going, you know, he's not thinking, okay, this is never going to work. It's not good for me. So, but inevitably, she falls in love with Stanley Baker, who is the new man on the boat, and who also, and this reminds me of something really cool about this movie that I didn't even know when I first started watching it. Stanley Baker comes aboard ship and through some of his actions actually gets the second in command from the guy who was thought that he was next in line because he had been with the ship for a long time, Robert Shaw. And I almost crapped myself when I saw Robert Shaw because I'm a big fan. And this shark, it's bad fish, but I'll catch him and kill him for 10. So anyway, Robert Shaw was in it, and it was a pleasing surprise. Very good movie. I really liked it. You know, a lot of some of the old movies, you know, don't hold up, but this one did. And the drama and kind of action scene that took up a great deal of the last part of the film when they're rescuing this ship in distress was really good. Had me on pins and needles. And to move on just a little bit quicker, I just wanted to go over that one because I really liked it a lot. There was another one that was on called The Sea Devils from 1937, and Victor McLaughlin was actually much, much younger in this one. It was pretty good. Also, you know, a movie at sea. It involves the United States Coast Guard. Preston Foster. Oh, my God. I got to say right now that this movie wasn't bad, but he was so obnoxious and so annoying because he was obnoxious that it really, I couldn't stand him. Ida Lupino was in it, very young at the time, and with blonde hair. But this one, you know, Sea Fury was definitely heads and tails above this one, even though Victor McLaughlin was still pretty good in this one. And his name was Medals. That was his nickname because he had so many medals. The next one was Lost Patrol, 1934. John Ford. Can't say enough about John Ford. I actually picked him on my favorite director on the 30 Days of Cinema, which Terry Frost, the Frost Giant, got me into, which I'm very glad because it really makes you think. And, you know, I don't want to pick two or three things for each thing. So I just, you know, John Ford, I looked up all the directors that I like, and his filmography is heads and tails above just about anybody. Lost Patrol, Boris Karloff. What more can you say about that? He's over the top, and it's very entertaining as he tries to drag these men who are under siege to Jesus Christ out in the desert when the Muslims are all over him. But it's a good movie. It's dated, and I thought Victor McLaughlin was good. I thought Boris Karloff was over the top, but he was good. A lot of the other people are, you know, there was only a handful because that's basically the concept of the story. But some of the acting from some of the other ones, Wallace Ford, Reginald Denny, left a lot to be desired, but it's a classic. And to finish this off, my Victor McLaughlin marathon was The Informer. And, of course, this won some Oscars, Academy Awards, if you will. John Ford again. The movie's dated. It was 1935, but it's still a good movie. has some very entertaining stuff. Like I said, you get McLaughlin in a pub, which for the majority of the movie, he's getting shit-faced and slugging it out and punching people. You know, just some of the ways that they shot him hitting guys with an uppercut or something like that is just hilarious, and it's almost Three Stooges-esque, you know, the way that they would shoot it. But it's still a serious movie, kind of a Judas-like story. I think probably a lot of the listeners, because they are cinephiles, have seen this movie. But I still like it, you know. And Frankie, she forgives me. I like the movie. Anyway, that's my Victor McLaughlin marathon, and I just want to say to Terry, Sal, Jack, and Jill, this is Dr. Zom from up the hill, the Harry Hounds of Hogarth. Smite the frost giant, but we also thank thee for bringing paleo cinema to the airwaves. Thank you very much. Dr. Zom saying, Dr. Zom, out.
Where else but here and where else but with Dr. Zom will you get a Victor McLaughlin impression in a podcast? I mean, really, that doesn't happen all that often. Yes, Sea Fury, I do have a copy of it because I picked it up because it was one of Stanley Baker's earlier films. Haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but it's sitting on the terabyte storage waiting to hit the top of the list. But I may move it up based on that. It was McLaughlin's last film too. I just remembered I saw him in Around the World in 80 Days, which I mentioned earlier in this podcast. He was the captain of one of the boats that Phileas Fogg, played by David Niven, took on his journey around the world, where they had to basically cannibalize the boat for wood to keep it going onwards. So yeah, great character actor. Originally English he was. He was English. His family moved to South Africa when he was young. Then he moved to Canada. Basically, yeah, interesting kind of... He was a bare-knuckle boxer for a while as well, which shows in his mug, I suppose. But one of those guys that came to acting after a very, very interesting life. And won the Academy Award in 1935 for The Informer. Nominated again many, many years later, apparently, for... let me just have a look at my Victor McLaughlin thing that I've got here. Won't be a moment. Yeah, it was nominated like 20, 25 years after his first win, which is really kind of unusual. Let's have a look here. Yeah, it was nominated for The Quiet Man in 1952, Best Supporting Actor. So didn't win, but he was nominated. So, yeah, another actor to add to our pantheon of cool actors. And, yes, Stanley Baker has been mentioned a number of times, basically because I like him. And thanks for your input, Zom. Always appreciated, mate, and always welcome. Anyway, time to wrap this puppy up. Thank you for your patience. If I sound a bit ugh, it's because I'm feeling a bit ugh at the moment. I do hope to be better next time when we do the B's. I'm going to pick two movies that start with the letter B. I've got a short list. I have acquired a short list, but I haven't gone through it yet and narrowed it down or shorter listed it for what I'm going to do. But I want to keep a bit of variety in it. In this case, of course, there were two very different films, a French New Wave film and a very kind of well-appreciated Hollywood movie. I want to keep that kind of dynamic happening with this and keep it interesting. Shout-out to everybody, the guys at GGTMC. I've got to listen to the latest episode because Zom told me something about it that I'm going to find very interesting. Of course, Hammockus and the wonderful people who do that one, including Brian. Let's see, Action Attraction, Metal Mikey's show, B-Movie Cast, of course. Vince is currently stoking the coals in a nuclear reactor, doing a lot of overtime, so he's got his backlog of episodes going until May. But thanks for yours, Vince. I owe a lot of people on this list voicemails. I fully appreciate that, and I will get around to it once life settles down a little bit and I'm feeling a little bit better. But and also, of course, the Australian ones, including I've got to do a special shout-out to Galactic Suburbia for opening my eyes to a few things. I don't always agree with Galactic Suburbia, which is a science fiction podcast from a feminist perspective, but the perspective I very much appreciate, and it's kind of influenced me, particularly with this episode, to look a little stronger at women's roles in movies and maybe with a more appreciation of what is said in the films and what isn't said in the films regarding women. And of course, everybody else who I've forgotten, because I am actually going to go and have a lie down after I do this to rest up and recuperate somewhat from my illness. Anyway, enjoy your movie viewing. I'm going to kind of crash out for a while. I've got a thumb drive with a bunch of films on it. I don't know what I'm going to be watching next, but I will watch something. Take care of yourselves. Thank you for listening. Thanks for all the feedback. Thanks for the love and support. And look after yourselves and enjoy your movie viewing until I come back in about 14 days. Bye.